Welcome. I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy with a continuing interest in effective pharmacy leadership. The purpose of this conversation with a successful leader is to hear in his own words the key aspects of his career so that we can glean tips and lessons for all of us. Because remember, effective leadership is different than being just a good pharmacist. I want to welcome John Ganz. By way of brief introduction, John received his pharmacy degree and doctorate from PCP, the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy, completed his residency at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. John's successful career has involved leadership positions within academia as a faculty member, as the chair of pharmacy, and as a dean at PCP. He most recently has been the Executive Vice President and Chief Executive Officer of the American Pharmacists Association. John, you recently retired from APHA. Tell us about your current endeavors.
Thanks, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here today. When I finished up at APHA, I knew I wanted to do something else, and I never really got my full of teaching. You sort of moved very rapidly into administration and then higher administration in the college, now university. And then on the APHA, there was no opportunity, although people told me I managed by teaching. I saw an opportunity and a need for leadership training and education, and there had been probably in the last 20 years a number of really good works that had been developed, mostly in the business community, about leaders. And we've heard the comment, leaders are born, you know, they're not made. And the reality is they're made, and they work very hard at their craft, and it's very challenging. And there was some real good information, certainly a lot of people with really good experience, both on the positive and negative side. So I thought I would look for an opportunity, and I met one of my former students. He thought it was absolutely critical, and we thought maybe some mixture of leadership, maybe some understanding of business, mm-hmm. and maybe a twist or two of entrepreneurism would really be helpful for all people who graduate from pharmacy. And so we took this idea to the university, and they thought it was critical, and they thought that it should be part of the core. Here it's in all their mission statements and things they're going to try to do, but they don't have any courses. So faculty wouldn't give up any of their scientific courses, but we're building a tract, and I think it's going to be real exciting and certainly enjoying doing it, and the students are really responding. They love stories.
Excellent. Let's benefit from your career experience. Did you, when you started your career, did you plan on having these various leadership positions, or tell us how that all came about?
I never planned. I started out, I didn't have a very good high school education. I was in a brand new high school, and we had two high schools that were side by side, and one had girls in it, and one had the boys. And we had 900 boys in the freshman class and 1,200 girls. So we had 2,100 girls in this high school and boys. And it was brand new. The teachers, they were building each year. There was nobody to, there weren't seniors to look at it in those days. And we didn't get a lot of science education. And we had science courses, we got credit. We were never in a laboratory. They had labs, but they didn't have the personnel, didn't have the equipment. And so when I ended up in pharmacy school, you know, this is 45 years ago, maybe 50 years ago now, my parents wanted one of their sons to go to college. And I was it, and I was working as a delivery boy in a community pharmacy. And, you know, the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy was the big school of pharmacy, and I started. Didn't do very well, and they thought I should take a year off and maybe take some prep courses. And I came back, and after a year off, did very, very well and kept doing better. And as I was finishing up, lo and behold, they were starting the Doctor of Pharmacy program. And I found out about hospital pharmacy practice, and I never knew the full story, but I was taking a position at the Hospital University of Pennsylvania as a staff pharmacist, and a residency opened up, and they said, you know, would you be interested in a residency? And of course, that paid a lot less. I said, well, I might consider it. You know what? And the way they explained it to me was that you would get 6 years worth of experience in 1 year. So you would be much further ahead because you'd rotate through every unit and, you know, the old standard residency. Mm-hmm. So I took that and got involved. And I spent a lot of time. I've always spent a lot of time at work. I never felt that I was gifted enough or organized enough to just get it done in 40 hours. And so I started making relationships with the staff nurses and the physicians, and had an opportunity to work on parenteral nutrition when they were just developing it in beagle puppies. And they had developed the procedure to deliver the product. And that opened up a whole new world for me. All of a sudden, I saw where physicians needed help, nurses needed help. There were a lot of questions being asked. And frankly, I didn't have the answers. And my education didn't prepare me for clinical therapeutics or pathophysiology or physical assessment or even to know the terminology. And so when I finished my residency, I got accepted into the doctor of pharmacy program, took the courses, and it was essentially a reworked master's in hospital pharmacy. And when I finished, got my degree, and then I wrote the dean a letter. But I wrote it with the chief of medicine's input as to what pharmacy education had to change. And they committed that they would help teaching pharmacists. So the University of Pennsylvania, which we weren't a part of and still aren't, said that they would help teach the courses, but this is where pharmacists needed to go. And the dean accepted it and asked me to come back to the college and work there full time as the coordinator of clinical instruction. And we redid the PharmD program and redid the undergraduate, the bachelor's program, and had a lot of great opportunities along the way. And, was presented with more and more opportunities. And I never really had a plan that I was going to become dean. That was never even, I mean, deans were like kings or queens. they were so far above you that I never saw myself doing that. But yet you just kept getting more responsibilities. And we did them well, and we had a great team of people, and they kept giving you more challenges. And the next thing you knew, they needed a dean, and they asked me to run the College of Pharmacy. So no, there wasn't a plan. There wasn't, you know, I had something written out that all these things were going to happen. And that's what I tell people today when I'm mentoring them: just whatever's before you, do it extraordinarily well, and something good will happen. And that's my plan, for lack of a better way of doing things.
Well, and it seems like a real key is when an opportunity affords itself, make the most of it, and don't shy away from it, even though you're not absolutely sure what it may be.
Right.
Would
it always
be
should
correct?
Be a absolutely
a stretch.
It always be a stretch.
Right.
Absolutely. And you should be, you probably should be cocky enough, at least early on, that you could do this. And in the clinical care of patients, pharmacy had no experience. So it wasn't like you could go to somebody and get some direction. We didn't have a legacy program. We had a program that was evolving. I remember when George Towns wanted to teach physical assessment, and he still teaches it. In fact, we teach a class at the same time, and I asked him the other day, what was he teaching? He told me it was physical assessment. People had no, you know, you want to get into diagnosis? No, but we want to get into being able to, you know, take a blood pressure, do certain things to monitor the effectiveness of the drugs and how well the disease was controlled. And so it was those kinds of things. It was really different. But we had a lot of people in upper administration who had our back and who mentored us in the ways of doing things. And that was really helpful. But no, it was different, different situation.
Early in your career, you were elected to the ASHP Board of Directors and were its president. How has that experience, or has it helped you the rest of your career?
That was, my residency was kind of a game changer. I think being involved in association work, and I did a lot of work with the Pennsylvania Society of then Hospital Pharmacists, and we had these two strong chapters, one in Western Pennsylvania and one in Philadelphia, and we called it the Delaware Valley Society of Hospital Pharmacists. And they were really strong, but there was nothing in between. And so we did a lot of work there, and I guess that got noticed. and I was a pretty good public speaker. And you know, so somebody said, you know, you've done the chairs in Pennsylvania, why don't you do ASHP? And that was another league to see an organization that was, you know, that well run, that effective with the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, and the different areas that you really had to get into pharmacy. They were really focused on advocating around those areas, not necessarily the government per se, but, you know, if you got it in the accreditation standards, pharmacy practice changed. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really, really good experience. You know, to be around colleagues of like mind who you had, who you held in awe, and you were capable of carrying your issues in the board discussions and providing the leadership, gave me a sense that I could do more. And I never really thought about association leadership or association management. You know, I was at the same time moving through the leadership functions at the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy. So I, but ASHP developed a national and an international network of colleagues. Mm-hmm. It exposed me to different aspects of healthcare that I hadn't seen before, opened the doors to Washington, which I hadn't seen. And, you know, I saw what an effective organization could do and how that if we were going to be effective in becoming patient care providers and patient care was going to be the center of our practice, then we needed effective organizations like ASHP, then APHA and others to be advocating our capabilities and what we could do. And that meant that you really needed these associations, and you were only going to be able to go so far with education. You could only train the pharmacists so well and educate them so well. You had to change the environment. You had to change the way pharmacists were paid, the way they were seen by other members of the healthcare team, and you needed strong advocacy, and so. An organization, bringing people mm-hmm. together, set mm-hmm. minimum standards, best practices. All of these things were what an organization could do. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's where I got my eyes opened as to what a great association can do, which ASHP is.
So in 1989, you had just become dean at PCP. What attracted you to the executive leadership position at APHA?
Oh, wow. I guess I felt like I had run the string out on education, and I was the dean, but that wasn't what I had set my sights on being. I loved my colleagues, I loved the students, I was tenured, I could have stayed there, but I didn't see practice changing to utilize the skills that these pharmacists that we were educating were capable of providing. Mm-hmm. And I saw the American Pharmacist Association, that's what we call it now, was the American Pharmaceutical Association, mm-hmm. as the best organization, okay, because it was represented the entire profession, is that's the organization that had to advocate and make this change and facilitate that. So it was essentially my heart was starting to leave because I believe if you're in retrospect, I didn't know this at the time, that you gotta love what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And if you love what you're doing, it just permeates what you're there for. And I love teaching. I love working with those Beagle puppies. The changes that we made in education, it was wonderful to watch the students respond to that, the faculty, the entire college changed. But I didn't see my life's work ending there. If you just couldn't continue to create better educated and trained people without changing the environment in which they were going to be practicing, how pharmacy was going to be paid, it was transaction based on a drug product. And so I saw APHA as an opportunity to do that. I really liked ASHP. I loved the experience I had there. I assumed APHA would be the same. That was not an assumption that was correct, but so I had my eyes open when I walked in the door at APHA. But my sense was that that was the right move. And we had a lot of fun. I loved what I was doing. So I think your heart's got to be in it, okay? And then your head's in it. And I think your heart, my heart was leaving the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy because I was searching for something to have to change. If you're going to build students and you believe in this, then you have to change out there. They just can't go out there and be filling orders as the primary thing that they do. Mm-hmm. And so that was the start. Okay. And then, you know, your head thinks about other things like your family and moving them to Washington and all of those obstacles. But so that's essentially what the transition was. But it was all about changing the environment and the practice opportunities for these wonderful graduates we were creating all over the country. It wasn't just in Pennsylvania.
So tell us a little bit about what APHA was like in 1989.
Oh, well. It was much different than on the inside than what it was on the outside. It was a wonderful organization with wonderful members, really dedicated pharmacists. But it was always, it seemed like it was always having arguments with other colleague organizations. And it didn't seem to have a central theme. And it was totally defensive. And its membership had fallen off. I think we had about 35,000 members when I started. And we had about a $4 or $5 million budget. They were significantly in the red. Their equipment, their systems, they were having problems with the state affiliates because they were under economic challenge. And I remember getting one of the best pieces of advice. It was from a state exec in New Jersey, Alvin Geiser. And Alvin said, you got to put this profession on the offensive. And, you know, I came there to change the environment and the opportunities for pharmacists. So we worked on a new mission statement, and that really started it. When we came out and got a mission statement passed, it seemed to, and it came out of my ASHP experience. It wasn't in my PCP experience. And it was a lot of people were thinking the same thing, that pharmacy had to be responsible for therapeutic outcomes, and we had to work with patients and prescribers and everyone else in the system to maximize therapeutic outcomes. And when we put that statement out and it passed in our House of Delegates, it gave us a new goal that we're still trying to, you know, totally fulfill. And I think it will last for the rest of the life of this, the United States for that matter, or the world. And it really caught fire. And it was really exciting to do. So when I went into APHA, that part of it was something you could do, but then the part that was more challenging, for me at least, was the business side, which, you know, I thought I knew a lot about business, but I didn't. I knew a lot about an expense sheet, and I could control expenses, Sarah, but I didn't know how to make the money, and I didn't know about accounting principles. So there was a lot to be learned, and those were areas that you had to pay attention to because it's a business. And when you're on the ASHP board and you work with a guy like Otis, you don't necessarily understand the business. They were so successful. There were always the financial resources and staff resources to do what you wanted to do. Here I was in charge, and you know that you had to build the finances and build the base of the organization. And so you were balancing both of those things, the advocacy professional side and the business side of the business.
Why don't you talk a little bit about how you develop that mission statement? Because you've said that's very critical. Mm-hmm. How did you get involvement and how, just, you know, as a thumbnail sketch, how does one go about doing that for an organization?
Well, what we did was I assigned a specific staff member, Ed Webb, and we began to go out and do a lot of listening. Mm-hmm. And people were talking at that time. They had a conference called Pharmacy in the 21st Century. And they had done a lot of strategic planning work and futuristic planning. And we had had, in ASHP, we had had the Hilton Head Conference. And people were talking about pharmaceutical care, sort of whatever that was. And that, it was starting to, people were getting excited about it. I mean, they didn't know what it was. And so we just listened to people, brought people in, listened to them, went to state meetings, went to all other national meetings, and just began to listen to people. And developed a draft and ran it by a bunch of people, and it got twinked, and it just developed a groundswell, a very broad base, you know, mm-hmm. academia, mm-hmm. all of the different areas of pharmacy practice, the boards of pharmacy, the colleges of pharmacy, everybody sort of got involved with it, mm-hmm. and it developed a real groundswell. And I think at the time, the idea of getting on the offensive, people were looking for a new vision.
Right.
It just couldn't be, you know, count 'em, lick 'em, stick 'em, and pick 'em, you know, right drug to right patient. That was a given. That was just accepted. Mm-hmm. You could get that done. I mean, we didn't have the technology we had today, but I mean, it was just accepted you could get that done. But what happened once the patient got those medications? And were they the right medication? Were they the best medication? And those kinds of issues were being talked about in academia, and we were building PharmD programs and clinical programs. But when you started bringing these people to talk to what the profession had to do and how it had to change, that really got resonance and traction, and that's how we did it. So I think it created that offensive move, mm-hmm. created a vision that people felt a part of,
mm-hmm. yes.
And they liked it. So I think those were the ways in which we kind of went about it and got a lot of feedback. And I think it passed almost unanimously. I think in our house there was some discussion, but not a lot. I think this is where the profession felt that it had a future, had an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Didn't know how we were going to do it, but, you know, and it was big enough and bold enough, and you weren't really going into anybody's turf because nobody was doing this. We were handing drugs to patients, and they literally didn't know how to use them. And didn't we have a responsibility there? Because in the end, it's the patient alone with their medication, and they make the determination whether they're going to take it, use it correctly, and there's usually lifestyle adaptations that you have to do when you take them. So all of those pieces came together to contribute this work. And so I think it created, as I said, a vision, but I think it created a kind of force that people wanted to be part of that. That's mm-hmm. what they wanted their life to be a part of. Mm-hmm. And academia fit it. Practicing pharmacist, it fit. It fit in every kind of practice. It wasn't just limited to community or hospital. Mm-hmm. It was in all of them. And so I think that's what happened. People were looking for something. And medications had grown up. We were dealing with much more effective medications. They had become a primary tool in the treatment of disease. Maybe the most used tool. Mm-hmm. And yet their outcome was mostly dictated by the patient, and the patient didn't know enough and didn't have enough support. So that's that. Okay. That I think okay. That's how it happened.
Now, one of the roles of any kind of leader is working through others, and you had state execs. Tell us how you got up to speed and how they worked, or how you worked with them as kind of lessons for others.
Yeah, it was interesting. The state execs were promised that the new CEO of APHA, me, was going to be one of them. They were told that by some board members. Well, I wasn't a state exec. And people went, John Gans who? You know, I was known in ASHP circles, but I wasn't known in their circles. And it was quite a bit, quite a challenge. And then you had camps. You had in those days, NARD, which was now retail druggists, the community pharmacist owners, they had their organizations now called the National Association of Community Pharmacists. But they had their states, and, you know, things were never going to change. But in the more progressive states, they had gone through the changes in their business, the changes in their model, and they were looking for something differently. So I went out and just listened, and I would go to state associations and not just give a speech and leave. I would stay to talk to their members. And so I developed mm-hmm. A rapport with them, and that sliced through a lot of the politics. And not everybody got on the bandwagon, but enough did.
Right. Well, you reached out to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is
yeah.
a real key.
I mean, you got to go to their turf. Right. They're not going to come to yours.
Well, during your years at AAPHA, you had a lot of victories. Why don't you talk about a couple of those that you think are significant and, you know, educate us on those?
I think one of the ones that probably will have a it's had a tremendous effect was the getting to the single entry degree in pharmacy. Big issue. The American Council on Pharmaceutical Education had decided that they wanted to consider moving in this direction. And we were supportive of that for quite some time, and some other organizations, ASHP, was supportive of it. But the voting, the approval mechanism for that was the American Council on Pharmaceutical Education, ACPE. And they had three votes from practice, which were identified by APHA, and they had three votes from academia, that were identified by the College of Pharmacy, and three from the Boards of Pharmacy. Well, the academics were kind of opposed to it, sort of split, and because it meant a lot of change for them, and they had to get new resources and move in different directions. APHA people were 100% behind it, and so the group that became the linchpin was the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, and a lot of their leadership was from independent community pharmacy. And so NARD was opposed to it. And we had to figure out a way to kind of see if we could bridge with them, because this wasn't in the best interest of the profession, and after all, they were pharmacists. And so we put together, I got together with Joe Otis and Charlie West, who was the exec of NARD and ASHP, and we got their presidential officers together, a couple of them, and we met two or three times and just talked through the issue. And eventually, NARD changed their position and supported the All-PharmD. And that meant then that, okay, APHA, NABP, that was six votes. The council was made up of nine plus one at large, and that meant we had the votes, and the colleges were split. And so it passed. And it passed on the basis that if you had a son or a daughter that was going into pharmacy, what would you rather them get, a BS degree or the Doctor of Pharmacy degree? And that sort of carried the day and created a lot of political issues as it moved forward and was being implemented, because the chain drug stores were opposed to it. But employers usually don't have a lot of standing in these arguments. And I think that going to the single entry degree has had a significant impact on the profession. If you just look at what pharmacists are doing today with that degree, it has opened up much more opportunities for them to be employed, make a living, and make a contribution to healthcare in all kinds of different areas. And getting more involved with the clinical care of patients and understanding what's going on and the therapeutics, all that. And now everybody was going to have the same basis. We weren't going to be, unfortunately, nursing's got two or three degrees still. It really solidified pharmacy's base. And at the time, some people were saying, geez, you know, we should close 20% of the schools of pharmacy. Well, we ended up, in those days, we had about 72 schools. We have over 100 today. There's many more pharmacists being graduated. They're all being well-employed. Their salaries are up. And so I think that was a really, really good decision, and one that I'm very, very proud of. There's many others, but I think one of the things that you were involved with was we didn't have good policy on pharmacy technicians, and you got involved with our policy committees, and we were able to get a policy through our house for new policy. And we worked with ASHP, NABP, and a couple of states to form the Pharmacy Technician Credentialing Board, and PTCB. And today there's over 300,000 certified pharmacy technicians out there supporting pharmacists. And a lot of times people look at pharmacy and they say, well, you know, it's not many people. Well, if you have 300,000 that are certified, there's probably another 100,000 that aren't yet. 400,000 people there who can probably do most of the drug distribution activities and the insurance processing. And then you have pharmacists now who have the ability to get involved with clinical services and medication therapy management with patients, solving medication problems, We now routinely do immunizations in every state. So pharmacists are reaching out and to get involved with other activities in the clinical care of patients. And we've doubled our manpower. And all of our people are doctor trained. And today I'm back in academia, and we have physical therapists going the doctorate route, nursing talking about a doctorate, and because they need more education. So I think we were spot on our timing. I think we did it the right way, and was very proud of the fact that was able to pull that group together and to just let pharmacists talk about this issue, and they came up with the right decision. They've never disappointed me, and they stuck to it. And the other day, the current head of the Community Pharmacists Association, Bruce Roberts, said we weren't the first ones, but that was the best decision the profession ever made. And so one of the things I've learned is that if you don't have to take credit for it and you can share the credit, at least in Washington, D.C., which is where we're sitting right now, they like to say success has many fathers and failure is an orphan. And here was a successful thing that other people got involved. And if that's the beauty, I think, of an organization like APHA, if you can work with other groups and move things forward, you can create an atmosphere of people listening to one another and getting other viewpoints. And that was one of the beauties of the Joint Commission on Pharmacy Practitioners. It just works, and it's not there to make a lot of decisions. It doesn't impose its will on people, but you do discuss issues through and you understand other people's perspectives. And out of that body grew PTCB. Not everybody was involved with PTCB. Not everybody was involved with our joint statement on the PharmD degree, but it provided the political support within the profession to move these through these two big agendas forward. And it's been extremely exciting, I think. So there are two things.
So describe who's a member of JCPP and how it functions.
It's a discussion group. And so, and it's every national pharmacist practitioner organizations. So I think there's seven or eight national pharmacist groups. Then we have the national group of state association execs. We have the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy. We have the American Council on Pharmaceutical Education. And there may be others, I don't have a list in front of me, who sit in the meetings and they have equal access to the floor. Then we put together an agenda, and we have a vision for moving the mission statement that we put together back in 1990. We've modified that and updated it a little bit, and we're trying to move that forward by 2015. Probably, I don't know whether we're going to make it, but I think it's a good goal, and we're trying to coordinate our activities, and people discuss it, and if groups want to work on it, everybody can work on it. Two groups, it was three groups for the joint statement on the PharmD degree. It was two national organizations for PTCB. So I think, and they meet quarterly, we try to bring in other groups that want to talk to us. APHA has now been asked to be the secretary to that. So Mitch Rothholz takes care of the keeping of the minutes and getting the agendas out and things like that. It's a lot of work. For example, we had the FDA commissioner come in and meet with us and his key staff. And so those kinds of meetings are really well received. We don't have NACDS in there, but and they were involved for a while. It's a different kind of organization. And we've got plenty of Walgreens pharmacists, et cetera, sitting around the table that are leaders in these other groups. So it's been real exciting to see that evolve. And I guess, I know it's over 30 years old now. It was going when I was ASHP president, started, and continued during my 20 years as exec at APHA.
So is it just the organization execs that meet?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. No, We bring in the chief elected officer and the chief executive officer of each organization. They have to be there or they can sit at the table. And people are very good about holding their schedules open and meeting. And then we have selected staff can come and sit and listen to the discussions. But no, it's the chief elected, and that's a good point, and the chief executive officer. And I think that's another, it keeps people, in the beginning, I guess there was a lot of divisiveness and backbiting and stuff like that. Today, we've talked about actually different structures for more formalizing a JCPP and talked as much as APHA becoming a different, becoming JCPP. And I don't think we were ready for that big step, but it obviously didn't work out. It would have been good, I think, but we've got the next best thing. We've got key staff member, Mitch Rothholz, is a VP of APHA, and he was my chief of staff, and he still serves in that capacity. So there's a lot of good work being done, and I think JCPP is functioning at a more comprehensive level, and we're putting more resources into it, all the organizations. And I think that that's a model that will continue. I don't think anybody has any reasons to shut it down. And we're doing more things. And I think eventually someday there may be some willingness to restructure a little bit, more along the lines of doing a better job of advocating for the profession. And the positions of these organizations have grown more more similar than they are dissimilar. I mean, there's going to be other hot buttons. But people are on this patient care thing and on this new mission, and that's the core of every organization. And it just depends upon where their members practice. They may have a little different twist, or they may have an issue that that one group has that the other group doesn't have.
You mentioned PTCB. Tell us sort of the history of that and its value, and educate us a little.
Well, again, going back to when I started, you couldn't say the T word, technician. I mean, it was used pretty commonly in ASHP circles, but it wasn't used in community practice circles. And people, pharmacists, saw it as a threat to their own occupation, but everybody had them, and it wasn't very formalized. And what we wanted to do was to come up with a program that would lend some structure to, I mean, some people were going through military training and they were extraordinarily well trained and they had a lot of experience. They were just phenomenal. They blazed the way on a lot of this. And but when you got outside the military, outside the federal government, you know, the practice of pharmacy is controlled by the states, not, and so we needed to change some things. And so we began talking about it, and a couple of states, Michigan and Illinois, had an exam, and they were kind of measuring the same things. And these credentialing processes they needed to be psychometrically valid, and they had to stand up in court, and it was going to be real expensive for them to take their exam to the next level, but they had to do that if they're going to stay in this area. They weren't national. So Joe Otis and myself and Carmen Catazone from NABP began meeting with two state execs from those two states, and Scott Myers and Larry Wagonick, and began to come up with an idea of merging their exams and taking it to a national level. And that's, in fact, what happened. NABP wasn't able to come in right at the beginning, but they came in several years later, and it had enormous impact. It was an idea whose time had come. The timing was right, and it was an explosively, I mean, when you go over a 10-year period, grow to 300,000 people, that's a large certification program. Mm-hmm. And then the state boards began to support it and use it. National employers like Walgreens and CVS and all kinds of organizations began using this credential. And today, it's probably one of the most successful credentialing organizations in the world. And They have a database of every certified tech. They recertify them every 2 years. So it's been a very positive thing. And that's the kind of stuff, it seems to me, that is coming out of JCPP to some extent. And it isn't tied to JCPP. These were three-member organizations of JCPP who got together and saw a need, saw an opportunity, and it made a great partnership, and it's worked very effectively. And so we're talking about other, when I left, they were talking about added qualifications and advanced technicians and to do other things, and I'm sure that that'll happen.
You and APHA were very successful with the whole political process in getting pharmacists the ability to do immunizations, to do medication therapy management, to get a provider status. Talk about how APHA functions with that political process and what some of that took, because I think that's very important as a victory that you had.
Yeah. The interesting thing, immunizations is a really good example, because what was happening is physicians didn't want to do immunizations. And state health departments, one of the metrics that was used to measure their effectiveness was their flu immunization rates. Mm-hmm. And so I was in Michigan with Larry Wagenknecht and Gary Cadillac, former president, now treasurer of APHA. And we were talking to a local congressman from the state of state congressman. And she said, can you guys help us out with immunizations? I mean, it's just terrible what's going on in the inner city of Detroit. We can't get these kids immunized. And we can't get, you know, and so we said, sure. And fortunately, the state law in Michigan was, I don't know whether it said pharmacists could do that or it just didn't say they couldn't do it. And the medical director for the State Department of Health was very supportive, because he saw, hey, this is an opportunity for me to get my numbers up that I'm being judged on. And so they pushed through regulations to do that. We worked with the CDC to evolve an educational program that they actually certified. And that was exciting. And so we began to train pharmacists to do this, and they were able to do immunizations. And it moved from flu vaccine through each state. But the beauty of it was you had to work with the state association and the colleges of pharmacy, who knew the local politics of the state, to make this happen. And so it just showed what you could do when people were on the same page in their advocacy. And it's kind of one of those funny things. It's kind of a sleeping giant. We saw that vaccines were going to become increasingly important. There were going to be, we were into HIV and AIDS, which is, of course, has been a challenge. We don't have a vaccine there yet, unfortunately. But, you know, shingles, vaccine for some of these cancers. This was a definite potential. And being able to deliver those through the pharmacy was a great new service, mm-hmm. revenue stream. And so people began to pile on and support it. And I got a kick out of it. I was at a meeting, and his speaker was up there, and he was telling everybody that his organization made this happen. And I was with somebody, and they hit me about three times saying, aren't you upset with that? I said, nope. I said, remember, okay, success has many fathers, and if he's taking credit for this, that's fine in this audience, and he's going to carry the water 5 more miles. So if you get on the right issue and you understand that that's controlled at the state level and look for your advocates, let me tell you, physicians, groups, organizations are opposed to this. Yet they acknowledge, practitioners will acknowledge that they don't want to do it. Yeah. Nurses were opposed to it. It's all a turf issue. And you've got to have strong, effective advocacy. And we've got to wake up practicing staff pharmacists that they have to engage in this, because corporate managers and corporate owners and directors of hospital or health system pharmacy departments are not going to be out there advocating. They have to do it. They have to advocate for their own practice. And it was just one of those things. And it's now, I think, in all states that you're allowed to do this. And varies a little bit what vaccines you can give, but it's clearly expanding. So it's exciting. It was a fun project. But you've got to have the advocacy shop and the people and the relationships. And people look at you the first time and say, what? And I remember one pharmacist, he told me, he says, you know, I thought you were nuts with this. And he was a San Diego-based pharmacist. And he had a couple of pharmacies. And he told me it was the highest margin and produced the most profit of anything that he did. The last year he was in business and sold his two pharmacies. And we were able to do all immunizations in California, all adult. And he had a travel clinic. And he told me the story of people coming in with and giving him their card. He said, and it wasn't their PCS card or their pharmacy benefit card. It was their Visa card. And the business was going to pay because they had to travel to China and they needed the vaccines and they needed them now. And I think it was, and it provides an instant outcome. It fit right into this new mission. You touched a patient, you had to take a history, you had to keep records. You got paid for that service, you got paid for administering it, and you got paid for the vaccine. So it kind of was kind of a full picture, and a very exciting thing to do. So, it's just one of those little things that moves the profession towards this overall mission.
What should specific pharmacists be doing in this advocacy? How can somebody be an advocate for the profession? What advice do you have for us?
All politics is local, and if you have somebody, and most of practice is controlled at the state, and so when you have someone that's running for the state senate or a state delegate in your neighborhood, support them at the beginning. And people say, well, you got to give them money. Well, if you're willing to phone, if you're willing to pull together a group of your friends, have a little social thing in your home, opening up those doors, especially to candidates when they're starting, before they've won that first election, builds a relationship with that delegate or senator, and that person will go to bat for you. You will have access to tell pharmacy's story. And if you want to have a broader practice, they're the people we have to convince. See them, I tell people, see them as the ultimate consumer. Usually they're in control of state government or local government or federal government. Federal government is the largest purchaser of just about everything in the world. And so if you're a senator, you can influence, what's being bought, how it's being used. And the customer is the federal government. And these are the people that sit on the board of that. And so I think it's real important to build those relationships. And if you want to have a viable practice and you want to have an expanding practice, there is new technology coming on all the time. And it's going to need more of somebody's oversight, of somebody's direction. This stuff, yes, it's not rocket science to us, but it is rocket science to the average consumer. And they need us to help them across that bridge to effective medication use and so that they achieve optimal outcomes. And that's we've got to be seen more in that arena. And if you want to do it, the way you get involved is to get involved as an advocacy organ, as an advocacy individual, and it's just a relationship. And talking to them every now and then. They want to hear from their constituents, and they want to hear to somebody that was there for them when they were starting out.
Tell us a little bit about the redeveloped building, APHA's building. Where are we located in Washington, D.C.? Mm-hmm. And you recently have sort of redeveloped that headquarters. Tell us a little bit about that, because that's pretty significant, I think.
Yeah, wow. That's another issue that when I went there, you have this beautiful location. And when you stand on the front steps of APHA, you are looking at the Lincoln Memorial, and you are looking at the Vietnam Memorial. And there's nothing between you and them except the street that runs down. And we got this unique location. I'm not exactly sure the whole story, but third or fourth president of APHA was a prominent Washington pharmacist, and he owned, his name was Kidwell, and he owned Kidwell's Meadows. And Kidwell's Meadows was part of the Potomac River, sort of marshland, and the Potomac is somewhat tidal. That was right at the end of what was becoming the National Mall. Now, this is way, way back. And they wanted to build the Lincoln Memorial or whatever, and they did some kind of a swap or whatever, and so where the Lincoln Memorial is on Kidwell's Meadows. They filled it in and built the Lincoln Memorial. And here's this beautiful building, and to draw a picture for people, there's Arlington Cemetery up on the hills of Virginia across the river, from the Potomac River, and then there's this road that runs right out of Arlington, right across what's called Memorial Bridge. And if people remember any kind of state funeral or anything like that, that's the bridge that runs, right. And on the Washington side of that, it's anchored by the Lincoln Memorial. And that starts the National Mall and runs up where Martin Luther King gave his speech, Reflecting Pond, the Washington Monument's in the center, and then the Capitol is at the other end. And so APHA is the only non-governmental building actually on the mall. And so we had this wonderful location, we had space, we owned it, but the building was way, way underdeveloped by today's standards. So we started thinking about selling it, and nobody wanted to do that because it was so unique. Well, could you develop it, and could it be a source of non-dues revenue for the organization? And that's what we set out to do, and we built six stories up, two parking down, and then another level below that. So it's about a 10-story huge building on top of that. And we leased most of it to the federal government. And so we were able to renovate the front building, which was a national monument. And it was designed by John Russell Pope, who was called the architect to the empire. And he did several prominent buildings in Washington and then many around the world. And we built a new building, and it was kind of the last thing that I was there for as the CEO, and we moved back into it, and it's spectacular. The views from the sixth floor where our offices are, you can see from the Supreme Court all the way to Arlington Cemetery, and it's beautiful, and it's quite a legacy for the organization and for the profession. So this is, you know, just one of those things. We did it predominantly to increase our presence, no question, okay, and make a statement on the mall. This is the pharmacist building. But also it was good business. So it gets back to that other half of that equation. When you're an exec of an organization, it may be nonprofit, but it no money, no mission, as someone once said, and you've got to have the resources to represent the profession.
So thinking back over your career, who are some of the role models or people that helped you, and what did they do for you?
Cast the thousands. They're, they just encouraged me, listened to me, supported me, saw something in me that I know I didn't see in myself. I had no idea. I get asked all the time, Sarah, by young people, well, how do you become the CEO of APHA? And I remember early on, there were a group of COSTEP students of the Public Health Service, about 20 of them. They were in Washington for a summer experience. And one of them asked me, how do I get your job? And I said, well, what school of pharmacy do you go to? And he said, I go to, I forget the name of it. I said, well, they don't have an all PharmD program, right? So are you getting a PharmD? No, I'm getting a. He said, I don't want to get a PharmD. I said, well, then you're not going to get this job, because the next time this job comes open, you're going to have a PharmD to get it. Oh, and the students went crazy. And I told them what was going on. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, this, you know, five-year degree and the six-year degree, and there were people talking about going all PharmD, and it was really unfair to them to not be able to get access to this. And that started the student movement through ASP, the Academy of Students of Pharmacy of APHA, and they have a big house of delegates to begin to basically vote on that and to really kind of move things forward. And so I think when I look at mentors and people along the way, I leaned on people all the time. And I think everything today, you hear people talking about teamwork. It was always a team. I guess it was because I was the first generation to go to pharmacy or to go to college. But it wasn't like I had this legacy of really well-educated Irishmen in my family. And so I was always reaching out for help along the way and building networks and building teams and listening to people. And I always found people willing to support me, help me, help me understand why things were the way they were. And now I find out later when I start reading these management books is that's what you were supposed to be doing, but it's just the way I did things. So when I look at people like, Linwood Tice, Herb Flack, Cliff LaChalet, a whole bunch of people in Pennsylvania. I had a wonderful experience the other night. I went up to the Pennsylvania Pharmacist Association meeting, and they wanted to recognize me because I was back in the state. And we had our issues with the Pennsylvania Pharmacist Association when I was at APHA. They were the only state organization that ever disaffiliated. And it was pretty embarrassing, your own home state disaffiliating. And people weren't happy about that. I'm at the meeting a couple weeks ago, and somebody asked me, I said, well, I guess now that you've come back and, we're going to give you an award tonight or recognition, you're going to rejoin. And I said, I never left. And he looked at me. He said, you mean through all of that, you never quit? I said, I'm a Pennsylvania pharmacist. You may have left APHA, but I didn't leave those roots, and I still use those people to help me. And I need that support. And I think if you're, the other thing I think, if you end up in the apex position of an organization, even if it's part of another organization, if you're leaning forward in bringing about change, which all leaders should do, that's going to be a team effort. And if I did it, it was just so lonely. You had to be people around you to encourage you. I just think that you've got to stand in that place where it's not what it used to be anymore. So that's kind of going away. And you're not to where you want to be. And it's lonely. It's empty. And without having a team and supportive, nurturing people around you, I mean, you're going to wither. And I've had a great family. My wife's terrific. My kids are great. The profession of pharmacy has been very nurturing to me. And as I move through, people like Joe Otis and Henry Manassi, we're good friends, and I'm not sure we're mentoring each other, but we're supporting one another all the time, and there are no vagaries between people. And someone once asked me, well, what is the key of mentoring or whatever? And mentoring is all about listening, I think, and not telling somebody the answer, but trying to help them so that they can think it through and maybe change their deliberation processes or their thinking a little bit. I saw a statement the other day from Will Rogers. It's not what I don't know that worries me the most. It's what I know and ain't so is the thing that really worries me. And I've seen a lot of changes in this profession and a lot of the basic tenets of which I believed I had to let go of. And boy, that's hard to do when you just hold these things as sort of gospel. This is the way it is. And you got to let them go because you got to move forward.
A lot of young pharmacists tell me that people like yourself, they're intimidated to come up and meet you if they see you at a meeting. Would you welcome a young person coming up and
that's the best part of my day. I mean, introducing yourself and sitting down and talking to people. I felt the same way. When I was growing up in the profession, and I think people were maybe a little less reachable in those days. I think there was a little more formality, but that's why I went back to this leadership position. I didn't go back there to run the college, I mean, or the university. I went back there to teach, to see whether or not I can use this wealth of experience and opportunities that I've been given to be part of, and tell stories to them in a way that helps them hang some of these principles of leadership, or business, or entrepreneurism, or change, helps them understand that it's okay to feel insecure when you're out there pushing a new idea. It's okay, but work with a team. And so you want people to come up to you. You want to have a chance to talk to them, and you want to take the time with them. And it is uplifting for me. It's energizing, and it's everything that I needed personally when I left APHA. I mean, it's, you know, there is a sense of loss there, the people, and some things you don't miss, but you certainly do miss. If you can help the next generation to be further up on that ladder than you were when you started, then they're even going to be more successful, and they're going to lead the profession to higher things, and healthcare is going to be better, and medication use is going to be better, and that's what I came here to do. So please step up and let's talk. So.
What's been the most satisfaction as you think back now in your career?
I was always impressed with people who had a degree of balance, and I don't believe that I had balance. I had a great wife and a great family who put up with a lot. But I had great supporting, nurturing organizations, be they the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy, be they the American Society of now Health System Pharmacists, the American Pharmacist Association. I think people, the one thing I had going for me is that I think I was pretty sincere and I was in it for the right reasons. I was trying to move the profession forward. And I think that gives you credibility, and people never failed me. And so I always felt very good about that, and that we were able to move some very important. We just didn't, as someone, I had a woman on my board, Martha Romore, said, we're not here to keep the board seats warm. We're here to do something. And I think, you know, that's what I was put on earth to do. And I was given a lot of opportunities, but there were always people there to support, nurture, and take me in different directions that I would have never thought about or done on my own. And coming out of the other side of this, I'm still married to the same woman. We still love one another. I have three wonderful children, and you know, I'm back now engrossed in students, and I don't think it could get much better than that. So I think we've seen pharmacy get better, healthcare get better. I know we've got tremendous young people in this profession, and experienced practitioners who want to see change and are willing to support them to make it happen. I think it couldn't be much better than that. Who would have ever believed we'd have, you know, all doctorate-trained people? Who would have believed we'd have technicians by our side? Who would have believed we would be giving immunizations? Who would have believed that medication therapy management would become something that's in every piece of healthcare reform that they're now deliberating in Congress? I couldn't have believed that when I started out. But, you know, you get the opportunities, and you have the kind of people around you, and come out the other side and you're still whole. Feels pretty good.
Thank you very much, John.
That's great. Wonderful. Thanks for the time.